During the Great Depression, the Works Progress Administration commissioned out-of-work writers, including Eudora Welty, Saul Bellow, Nelson Algren, and Ralph Ellison, to document American regional cuisines. Pat Willard has followed the trail of the never-before-published manuscript they produced in her latest book, America Eats, on the road with the WPA, the fish fries, box supper socials, and chitlin feasts that define real American food. It's published by Bloomsbury, and I'm pleased that it brings Pat Willard to the show today. Hi.
Hi, Leonard.
So how did you come across the manuscript?
Well, I was doing research for another book, and everything that I read in the academic culinary food world, there was some, every now and then there'd be a reference to these papers, and they were intriguing enough that I thought I want to go down to the Library of Congress where they were to find them.
So other people had used them as reference, but nobody had ever published them?
Historians and sociologists were kind of combed through them through the years, but they never really, it would always be like a line, very tantalizing line or two through their books. And
well, how did the original project even get its start?
Well, it was part of the Federal Writers Project, and that was part of the Work Progress Administration, put people back to work. So they wanted to put writers going out. And so that project started a whole lot of books. Most what we know of it is the city guidebooks and slave narratives and work narratives. And towards the end of it, they started looking at how America lives. And, of course, one of them was the food. And there was an editor in Washington who really had far-reaching thoughts about how American food came together. So she decided that she didn't want any food writers. She just wanted to send normal, regular, out-of-work reporters and out. And they were forbidden to actually write about the food. She wanted to write about the culture and how the food developed, which was a fairly far-reaching idea.
Group eating and social context is really important here.
Right. It was a stroke of genius because what she understood was that the unique thing about American food is that because there was no indigenous, well, there was the Indian culture, but because we were so thrown together by the way the country grew, food became a way that we became partners with each other and communities with each other. So people from wildly different backgrounds could get together over a meal and discuss town events or little, their tent events and over dinner. And then by that way formed our food.
I mentioned some of the famous writers who were involved. Right. Were they just as anonymous at the time as the writers whose names we don't remember?
Absolutely. They were just getting started on their legs and felt fortunate enough to get a job. And a lot of them have actually credited the Federal Writers Project for getting them to feel like writers for the first time, and that was something that Ralph Ellison said. It was the first time he got paid and could really do things that he liked.
And what did Ralph Ellison do? Because he's a city boy, and most of this is about rural stuff, isn't it?
Right. Well, the big cities and the big cities kind of were rich, in, as you would imagine, rich in talent. New York City being just overflowing with all kinds of people. And Ellison was part of the New York Project. And he just latched onto it, and he was given these assignments of going out in the streets. And part of the work that I found that seems to be his, and then I say that very loosely, are these street peddlers chants. And you can hear the reverberation of it through Invisible Man and his other work. So it was really fascinating to see that.
So none of this was signed. You had to figure out who did what.
Very few was signed.
But some of them have discernible styles. I would imagine Eudora Welty might.
Well, she actually, the interesting thing about her is I found a manuscript in the paper. She did it for the Mississippi Advertising Board. And it's her take on five little plantation towns. And so it's filled with just all these wonderful, cranky old Southern recipes. In her voice, you can hear her voice straight through it.
You've also given us some recipes in this book.
Yeah. They all came from, I say 9/10 of them came from the WPA. And part of that was kind of interesting because they didn't want recipes in the book at all. But the writers we're disobeying the editors all over the place as writers.
Well, sometimes it's hard to explain something without telling you how it was done.
Right, yeah. And a lot of the writers actually stood by the people's stove or out over the fire and took notes on how things were done.
My guest is Pat Willard, whose book, America Eats, On the Road with the WPA, the Fish Fries, Box Supper Socials, and Chitlin Feasts That Define Real American Food, is published by Bloomsbury. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So they went to a lot of small towns and such, and you decided to retrace their steps?
Well, what interests me about it, I write about food, but I'm more of a writer than a cook. And the thing that really tantalized me, first of all, were the voices of these forgotten writers and the stories that they told, which are so rich and lost, really. And then the other part
of it, lost America? Or do you think that this is kind of an America we would recognize with some changes?
We're starting to recognize. I mean, there's lineage there. You know, we're such a young culinary country. And if the thing that gets my dander up when I get hackles, because a lot of food writers kind of take us to task for that, not factoring in that the great glorious foods have had centuries to evolve, and ours hasn't. It's you know less than 300 years. So what my idea was to go out and look. Go back on the trails and see what's there now and how it's evolved. So I found a lot of the towns and a lot of the little festivals that were there.
Well, as we said earlier, it focused on group eating and social contexts. On your travels, did you see that those social communities were still thriving for the most part?
They were, with significant changes. One of the big changes was that a lot of the community feasts were organized and run by women. And since women have gone back to work in droves, they're not that big of a motivating factor. So a lot of the ones that the folks wrote about in the WPA have either grown smaller or were gone for a while and now coming back as part of a way to revitalize a community.
Well, but communities have also changed. Small town America is changing, isn't it?
Well, yes, it is. But you know what? It's fascinating to see now in this particular time of how we're starting to hearken back to the ways we get together and get through hard times.
Well, many people have said that that we don't cook as much nowadays as we used to, but then I've heard reports that during hard times, people start cooking at home again.
Yeah, I mean, it's a thing that's really particular to American culture because, again, I think that's how our heritage was. In order to survive out in the wilderness, you had to get together. So I really feel it's inbred into us. So one of the knee-jerk reactions we have to hard times is, you know, let's throw a potluck dinner, let's get together with a bunch of friends and eat.
And you write about two stews that were made for huge numbers of people, Minnesotan Booyah
right.
and North Carolinian Brunswick stew.
Right.
Do they continue to be made?
Absolutely. Minnesota's Booyah is such a part of their heritage that in St. Paul, if you've ever been to St. Paul, the big parks had these what's called Booyah huts, and they were in disarray and disrepair. And when the city decided they didn't have the money to do it, there was this outcry that the death of some kind of heart of the city was going to be lost. So people quickly found out a way to get them back and running again. And they're a real true fundraising feast. People get together with their friends or recent little organizations, and they'll go around putting on these huge big pots of soup, which is
what we're talking about. 100 people or more being served out of one stew.
Well, that's the great thing about these recipes. Both these recipes, you can't make them for, I mean, you can make them for six, but really the recipes call for at least 50 to 100 to come.
And both contain squirrel meat when WPA writers wrote about them. Has that changed?
Unfortunately, yes. I was dying to find a squirrel meat.
Well, Americans are eating less roadkill or whatever other animals, but we also eat less awful. And chitlins are part of your story, which
chitlins
we'll get to later.
Yeah.
People don't eat that as much anymore either.
Right, yeah.
Where does the name Booyah come from? Do you know?
Well, there are several legends about it. When I was in St. Paul, there was a couple of people who swore that it came from a corruption of Bula Base because there was a contingent of French traders coming down, which didn't quite make sense. I mean, because there's nothing seafood about it except that it's a big pot was throwing things in. And there's a big German population and there's a big Irish population. So it's a corruption of something. You know, it's just one of these folklore.
And were the writers at the time trying to trace these back to their European origins?
No, not at all.
I mean, this is something we would think of right away, isn't it?
For the European customs?
Well, I might see something and think, well, how did that come about? Was that because there were a lot of Irish people in the area and so they made such and such?
No, what was really interesting about the papers, and if you go back to the administration papers, there's this huge arguments going back and forth because the editors wanted what they called American dishes. And so when the writers went out, especially to ethnic enclaves, which basically was anywhere, they would have to go back to the editors and go, is this American enough? And then the editors in Washington would make that distinction. But it was very arbitrary.
Is a stew an American dish or not? Is a barbecue an American dish or not?
Stew is. And, well, certainly barbecue. Stew is in that the sense that if you think of how settlers ate, they only had a couple of utensils. It was usually a big pot. You just throw whatever you have in there and let it simmer for a while because the meat would be tough, and it was a way of making it edible. And if you look at the bouillon and the Brunswick stews, they're still made in these huge cauldrons. And again, barbecue was another way of cooking that was specifically to America, but it grew out of the lineage of the conquistadors and how they ate. So what I found interesting in traveling around was that American food developed really depended on who was conquering the land. And that's something I don't think we really paid enough attention to. In the Southwest, it was the Spanish, and in England, New England, it was the English, and so forth, and the French and the Midwest.
Well, the roots of barbecue, which you said is American, go back to the Caribbean, don't they?
Right, and the slaves.
So it's imported in an odd way, even if it's from the New World.
Yes, it's a mixture because if you think about it in terms of there's the Spanish heritage, there's the African American heritage of cooking over a flame, using spices, and there's so many different varieties of barbecue. It's not just one aspect. It depends where you are in the regions.
Well, we are usually associated with the South, but there's barbecue all over the country, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, if you ask a Texan, they'll yell at you. it's not Southern.
Was barbecue as big when the WPA writers were writing about it as it is today?
Yes, within the regions. So folks anywhere above Virginia didn't know about barbecue. There wasn't barbecue restaurants. If there were, there were very few and far between. So the food was extremely regional at that time.
Were they, at that time, were they popular for political rallies as they are today?
This is the thing I found so intriguing, and I love the quote that I found where someone said, barbecues are perfect for, I'm going to get this wrong, barbecues are perfect for political gatherings because it takes the meat and is so aromatic and so long that the people will stay around for the politician to finish his speech. It was, starting from, I guess, the Kansas on down, if you want a group of people to come and listen to you, you threw a barbecue.
And you also can make it in large quantities,
yes,
as you can the stew.
Yes, yes.
Pat Willard's latest work is called America Eats, On the Road with the WPA, the Fish Fries, Box Supper Socials, and Chitlin Feasts that Define Real American Food. It's published by Bloomsbury. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. Pat Willard is here. Her book, America Eats, On the Road with the WPA, published by Bloomsbury. How much a part did drinking alcohol play in these community events? Because Prohibition had ended in 1933, and that wasn't long before these people went out to check out on American eating.
Ah, there is always drinking at these things, but it was the men went around to the barns and they had their corn whiskey in there, and the women were not allowed to drink. But there's this really lovely little passage in the New York chapter where they wrote about the changing mores and how women are now drinking Tom Collins's. But there was a fair amount of drinking going on.
At many of the community eating events, size mattered. There's that mile-long trench filled with smoldering wood for barbecuing, the contest for largest produce, and a 2,300-pound, 10-foot-wide apple pie in Wenatchee, Washington.
We like to show off in our culinary.
Are we still doing that sort of thing?
We are. There's this huge strawberry sundae that's made every year in Washington State.
Maybe it's Washington State.
Yeah, it is Washington State.
They're into the largest thing. Well, I once attended a wedding at the Mono Indian Reservation in the Sierra Mountains in California, and one of the things that you write about is something that I experienced. They dug a ditch, and then they put burning logs or burning wood into it, and then they threw a whole cow.
Yeah.
Whole cow, not skinned, and then they covered the whole thing. And then 2 days later, opened it up.
Right.
The cow had been cooked, and they skinned it, and then they chopped up all the meat and put it into huge bowls. And
how
people,
was it?
It tasted like barbecued meat, slow barbecued beef.
Yeah.
And it was a brilliant way of doing it.
Yeah, and you still sometimes see that. But part of it is first of all, I think there's so many regulations now. They used to dig these ditches in parks and city parks, and no one's going to do that now. And then the health regulations come because you're thinking of throwing a big cow into a dirt hole, right? So,
Well, it does have its fur. I mean, it has not been skinned, so nothing is really exposed to the fire.
Yeah, but I would bet a bunch of health agents would come swooping down on that. But on another take on that, one of the things I found particularly important about these papers was how they documented Indian cooking and how Indians, their role that they played in the development of American food. Because one of the great things about these papers is that they were written at a time when we were teetering on different ways. There were still people alive who had crossed the prairies. There were still cowboys. There were Indians who remembered, even if vaguely, their old ways.
And there were people who had been involved in something like a genocide against
Native
Americans.
Right. And then on the other side, right before the war, we were not quite so into the scientific food. Canning, it was there, of course, but not as bad as it was going to be. We were still eating fairly fresh, fairly good from small farms.
I'm glad you said canning, not as bad as it was.
Not as bad, but soon to get very bad. So it's this time capsule of when food was really pretty damn good in America.
Most of the places that you visited were rural. You're from Brooklyn. Did you feel like you were some kind of outsider at these times?
Well, there were times when I felt a little, a lot of times I traveled by myself, so being out there in Oklahoma by myself, in a really rural area, that kind of got scary, and Mississippi was a tiny bit. I stuck, you try not to stick out. And so I dressed very, I didn't dress like, well, I don't, like, whatever. I mean, I tried to blend in.
You wore a burqa like everybody else.
Yeah, exactly. But I would open my mouth and there was that accent. So I really tried to play things down. But it was weird for people to come up to me and like, I'm this woman all by herself. Going, who are you?
Were they open about talking about their food? traditions?
Well, on Indian reservations, they weren't. So that took a lot of just sitting around and, you know, patience. And then there were the sheep herders in the sheep herders in Boise, Idaho, where I had to – that was a very male population. And when I went to their sheep herder ball, I had to invade their little – and invade, I mean, I just walked into their bar where all these nice old men were sitting around with big coffees and cigars. And a lone woman was not – I was not welcomed. And it was a very close-knit population. So I – went to their feast, and they were very nice to me, but I was definitely the odd person out. So,
we got a call from a woman named Adina, who is in an IHOP, and she says that IHOP has been around for 50 years. Pancakes are good food for hard times.
They certainly are. Yeah.
And IHOPs are big all around the country.
Right.
Did you find that some of the places that, you know, we tend to think of these things as being out in the open or
right.
in people's homes, but how much of all of this writing took place in restaurants?
Well, the papers, and this is, again, this goes back to how the papers were developed by the editors. The editors felt the people to do city restaurant kind of food was New York, so there was a lot of writing about the New York restaurant scenes. But
they had to deal with immigrant food, didn't they? Food from Europe?
They did, and they called it foreign food. But that was the only place where they were allowed to talk about foreign food. You know, and they had this whole little section of a lot of different groups. It was interesting.
Uh-huh.
But every now and then they would say something. Oh, the other place where they wrote about restaurants, but it was in a total negative, was Los Angeles. The editors despised Los Angeles, this real East Coast kind of elitism, and they saw it as a den of iniquity. There was all this, you know, weird fat food, and so the writers came in with this glorious piece about all the great restaurants that the movie stars were going to and health nuts were going to, and the editors were appalled and wouldn't use it. So that manuscript is there.
And yet the whole thing was never published. Do we know why it was never published?
Well, Congress never particularly did not like the Federal Writers Project because they were a bunch of writers. So they thought a lot of times that the writers were they were supporting communists and they were just kind of like out there. So
was there a political side to some of these pieces?
Yes, very much so. And in fact, the New York office was constantly being tried to shut down because they were trying to unionize and they were a bunch of terrifically retro base, that's all I can think of, but they were great people. Anyway, so this book was probably one of the last ones that was ready to go to press, and Congress pulled the money because we were about to enter World War II, and they really, you know, decided that was better than printing a book about American food.
Overall, on your travels, did you find that the modern-day food celebrations were similar to the ones written about during the Great Depression?
They were, in the sense that there was the same feeling of being together, of really celebrating a community, of knowing each other and doing something together that they were really proud of. The difference, there's a slight difference in the sense that the food is really sort of getting a little better, that they're really interested in bringing in really good food to cook with the community. So we're not talking about, for instance, a Booyah festival where everyone's bringing in crummy cans of corn and lima beans and like that. They're really looking for the fresh ingredients.
Because this is later in the Depression, so
right. Things
had gotten a little better. Do you think we would have gotten something very different if it had been written in 31 instead of, it was 35 or so?
No, because the papers started, these particular papers started to be written in about 32, 33. There's a long leeway. And with a lot of Federal Writer projects, they culled from other papers. So some of the stories that you get in this book were they originally reported by the slave narratives or the guidebooks.
Interestingly, New Orleans is also underrepresented here.
It is. And again, it was because they saw it as Cajun food, which they weren't quite sure was American enough. which is really interesting. So I would think that you would find a big chapter on it, and it ended up being, unless something's lost, and a lot of these papers are lost or scattered across the country, and there's some effort to try to get them all together. But what was in the Library of Congress and what I could find just scouting around was about two or three stories about Cajun food, and they were very just small, evocative narratives about someone cooking.
It's interesting. It suggests that no matter how much you try to make something like this as all-inclusive as possible,
right,
people are going to have agendas.
They certainly are, especially if it comes from Washington.
America Eats on the road with the WPA, the Fish Fries, Box Supper Socials, and Chitlin Feasts that define real American food is Pat Willard's latest book. It's published by Bloomsbury. You grew up in Philadelphia, in case people didn't recognize the accent. Did you grow up eating any of the local special regional foods? Were Philly steaks big? And what about
something
like Scrapple or something like that?
Oh, well, yeah, I have to have my fix of Scrapple every now and then. I was really lucky growing up in that my father was a community organizer in this a blue-collar neighborhood in Philadelphia. And it was really hard hit by mills closing. And the great thing about this neighborhood was that it was made up of five distinct ethnic groups that didn't quite get together, but they coincided side by side. So as being, my father would pull us to all of these potluck dinners and church suppers and things like that. So this seemed normal to me. This was the way I learned how to eat food and kind of like blending together. So I understood how important community dinner and dining can be to the community, to the life of the community and the welfare of people. That's what really latched on to me when I started looking at these papers.
Do you think Philadelphia, even though it's a huge city and used to be, I think, the third largest city in the country or somewhere up there, not anymore, but do you think that it's very different from a city like New York or Chicago or Los Angeles?
In what sense?
It has this stronger sense of potluck community.
I think it's like any other city. I think it's like New York, and if in the sense that there's all these little neighborhoods, all these little communities, and within those communities, they do things certain ways. So like my little neighborhood in Brooklyn does things a little bit different, but it's, we get together as a community, and that's what I mean by it's part of us and our culture.
Were you trying to preserve some of those traditions through writing this book?
Yes. I think that they're really central to us. And I think as we go further into, whatever happens in the next couple of months and years, that we understand this is a way to get through things.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned the next couple of years, because a listener from the East Village left a comment.
Oh, no.
He said it would be great if we could have a WPA-esque project like this now, not to report on what people are eating, but to educate them about what they could be eating, fresh,
right,
local produce, for example, that is not the processed junk.
Right.
I'm quoting. I don't believe that. I only believe in processed food. Velveeta is the only cheese I eat. There are too many neighborhoods in which people don't have access to decent, healthful, fresh, local
right.
food.
I think it's one of the, I think there's many people who were very thrilled when Obama said that he was looking at different projects to get together, and they're hoping that something like the WPA will come together with all these great ideas.
What do you think would have happened if a similar project had been established in France or in Germany? Do you think it would have had the same kind of feel, or do Europeans have more of an involvement with food than Americans?
They're a much more homogenous culture. You know, they are of a people. The great thing about American food, and something that I hope these papers show, is that our food is constantly evolving by the people, the new people who come here all the time. There's this intertwining of flavors that happen.
So we, for in the 60s, there was no sushis. By the sushi in the 70s,
it's everywhere.
You couldn't turn a corner without finding
right.
another sushi bar.
And on top of that, people are learning what to do with pickled ginger, other than making sushi with it, or seaweed, or, you know, so we're evolving recipes constantly. And that's a glorious thing about American food. And I think not enough attention is being paid to that. Yes, we have classic dishes. They perhaps may not be, you know, what some snobs may think of as the glorious dishes of France or Italy, but we should take enormous pride in these dishes that come from so many different cultures.
There are people who feel that, for the most part, the traditional American cuisine that we've been discussing
right.
is disappearing as French techniques are used to cook even traditional American dishes.
Yeah, well, you know, life evolves. You have to move on. The techniques will stay the same. We will have this bedrock of heritage food, heritage dishes, but we evolve, as all cultures do.
Although you talk about chitlin feasts, we're seeing fewer
yeah.
and fewer. People don't want to eat intestines anymore.
Have you ever tried them?
I've eaten tripe. I like tripe a lot.
Well, I bet you really like chitlins. It depends on where you go. Chitlins are still hanging out. Oh, not hanging. Well, they are hanging out in themselves.
We won't discuss that. That's one of the more ugly visual images I've had
but
recently.
But they're very
on the show.
Delicious, I have to say.
Pat Willett is the author of Pie Every Day, A Soothing Broth, and Secrets of Saffron, which was nominated for an IACP award for the best literary cookbook. She has written for Bon Appetit, Ladies Home Journal, American Heritage, and the Los Angeles Times. And now she has this book, America Eats, On the Road with the WPA, The Fish Fries, Box Supper Socials, and Chitlin Feasts That Define Real American Food. It's from Bloomsbury. Thank you so much for being
Thank
with us.
Thank you, Leonard. It's been wonderful.